True or false? Donald Trump's tariffs this week included islands only inhabited by penguins. Madge, you're going to go first, and then Corey.
That's I'm going to go with true. Okay. It's going to get a wrong one off the bat.
Corey?
Yeah. I'm going to go true. It sounds absurd and exactly consistent with what's been happening.
True dictator power, right? Only a dictator, authoritarian person can come up with that. It is true. Both point.
Okay.
So, true or false? This is over to you first, Corey. Kid Rock, who's obviously connected to the Trump campaign, has built on his property a replica of the White House. It includes a golden toilet. True or false, Corey?
Wow. I mean, that seems so consistent with Kid Rock's personality and, again, with the absurdity of the moment. It's almost too easy, but I think I have to go true again.
Think true, Madge?
I'm going to go with false.
Don't think it's...
I feel like if they were going to introduce Kid Rock at some point, they'll say he's recently built a White House in his estate with a golden... I feel like that's how they would introduce... That's how I would introduce it. Like a sports announcer.
It is true. He has built a mini White House. Sorry,
Madge. To be right.
That's too long.
Yeah. It does have a golden toilet.
These guys are so lame. They're so lame.
This is over to Madge. Linda McMahon, who is the Secretary for Education in the Trump cabinet, turned up this week and joined in with a press conference led by the Democrats criticizing education. So she was involved and stood with those Democrats.
That sounds true. That sounds true. We had a British politician do that during the P&O stuff. So there was a load of ferry workers who got sacked. And then she joined in the protests where she basically allowed the laws so then they could get sacked. So then they started booing her. So I'll go true.
You're going to go true, Corey?
I mean, she has been doing nothing but attacking our educational institutions. And so, again, doesn't seem out of character. And common sense tells me, I mean, the one thing about joining Democrats, that sounded a little... I might have to go false on that.
No, I'm cooked. False. It's cooked. I'm cooked.
It's true.
Let's go. Back in the game. Let's go.
She actually turned up. Yeah, we had an MP that did the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Wow. Really weird. Final question.
Oh, it's Point Break.
This is very competitive. This is the most competitive podcast I've ever been on.
Denmark this week has started a campaign to buy California, Corey.
I love it. I mean, I hope that's true. I'm going to say true. I mean, it's too brilliant and appropriate to not be true. And if it's false, we should make it true. So let's say true.
Madge.
I'll go with false. I don't think they could afford California. I feel like if they said like New York or something, it would make more sense.
Staten Island.
Yeah.
It's true.
Staten Island.
It has happened.
It is true. There you go.
Corey, congratulations.
Thank you. Awesome. Wow.
2-1.
I've always dreamed of this moment, I have to say.
It's a big win. You got the most outlandish statements correct. The most outlandish questions I've heard all week.
Talk about that's the theme of the moment. The most outlandish
thing. If it's Donald Trump, I'm just going to guess true on everything. It's like he's been to space. True.
Welcome everyone to the Sunday Roast, and we have a very, very special guest this week. Corey, could you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Well, thanks so much for having me. My name's Corey Brettschneider. I'm a professor of political science, and I teach constitutional law as well at Brown University, and I've been there for 22 years, and thank you. I also am an author. I've written some academic books about free speech and about the role of courts in democracy. But when Donald Trump ran for office, I wrote a piece for Politico called Trump versus the Constitution, a Guide. And it outlined each of the proposals that he was making, not too dissimilar from the things we're going to talk about today, and talked about why it violated our Constitution. And then when he won, I realized that I had to shift from talking just to professors to trying to speak out against the horror that we were seeing. And I wrote a book called The Oath in the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents, with the hope that there would be future presidents. And also the book that I know you've been looking at, The Presidents and the People, Five Leaders Who Threatened Democracy and the Citizens Who Fought to Defend It. And what that book is about the sort of dangers inherent in the presidential model, as opposed to the Westminster model of executive power, that the presidency is so dangerous that from the beginning, people like Patrick Henry warned that it was really a risk, because we were assuming at the founding of the United States, George Washington or a virtuous person. But he said, Patrick Henry, in saying, don't ratify this thing. What if you have a bad person? Or what if you have, hypothetically, a criminal president? The institutions won't hold. There is a danger of collapse of the system into dictatorship, into monarchy, even, Henry said. What's to prevent this person from becoming a king? They might declare themselves a king with their own power, and not the kind of good king of, you know, constitutional monarchy, but the sort of dangerous absolutist kind. And the thesis of the book is we've seen that danger emerge before Trump five times. People like John Adams, who shut down the opposition party, or President Buchanan, who denied really all rights to Black Americans under the Constitution. Woodrow Wilson, who spread white supremacy through a kind of nationalism. He wasn't the first white supremacist president, but the first white nationalist president. And finally, Richard Nixon. And I talk about his crimes being way beyond Watergate, really a true criminal presidency. But the hope of the book, this isn't a depressing book because it's got hope in it, is that rather than public officials, citizens fought back and reclaimed democracy using the Constitution. Mm. Courts often make things worse, but citizens engaging in politics to reclaim democracy through elections like the election of 1800, a referendum on the shutdown of the opposition party, have often reclaimed democracy. So it's a risky system that we've got, and we're seeing it right now in the form of Donald Trump, but there also is this hope of citizens fighting back. So, you know, that those public-facing books and the conversations around them have led me to actually also start a podcast, now 8 weeks old, but we're, I think, pretty doing extremely well in the government category. I think we're five today. It's with John Fugelsang, who's a longtime SiriusXM host and was one of the original VJs on MTV. Wow. And it's called, after my first book, The Oath in the Office. And so he's a comedian as well. It's light. It's fun, like your podcast. But it also is deadly serious about the threat to democracy at the moment. So that's The Oath in the Office. And check us out. I think we have a similar vibe from what I can tell. And really glad to be with you. Thanks so much for having me on.
Great intro. And yeah, like we're really pleased to have you on. Max, do you want to give yourself an intro? And then
well, I can't be an intro like that. But, you know, give it a go. Yeah, I'm Big Match Studios. I run my own YouTube channel, the Big Match Studios channel. I'm not an author or a professor. I'm just a dude. I read a couple of books on like presidents and stuff, the US president, the role of it. And you know, the one I read was Presidential Power and the Modern Presidents by Richard E. Neustadt. That was a really good book. That was really interesting. I tried to read Taming the Prince, but that was way too confusing for me. That was a crazy book. But this one I recommend if people want to learn more about like presidents and things like that. And we've got Alex, who's also a historian, has read, big nerd on this kind of stuff as well.
Big nerd. I'm big happy nerd with that title.
Talk about that. I was sorry to interrupt, but I talk about that. That book is such a major book for the study of the presidency. In fact, if I were to pick one, that might be it. And I tell a story about it in The Oath in the Office, which is that one of Nixon's staffers who had been indicted met Neustadt, and he said, you know, Nixon gave your book to everybody in the White House. And he said, so you're basically responsible, too, for what happened, because it's all about how you aggrandize presidential power using rhetoric. And Neustadt said, I couldn't believe it, because when I was in school, we had civic education and we learned about the law as a constraint on anything. And I assumed that even though I was talking about power, you know, it was all within the boundaries of the Constitution. But that really shows you where we are now, too. We don't have people reading, teaching about basic civic education or the norms that you have in the UK and we should have here, but don't, of the respect for the rule of law.
I mean, we had three topics, which was the third term deportation and tariffs. But after seeing, I mean, there's so many directions we can go in with this. I just thought it was quite interesting because obviously we're talking about leadership and restraint models and Westminster model versus the US model. Mm. It was really interesting because I almost felt with the tariffs this week, you had America has had, the world has had a Liz Truss moment, but with the president, But the interesting thing with the UK is when Liz Truss did something so bad that it wrecked the economy, there was an immediate removal process and no one questioned it. And yet Trump has done something, $2 trillion wiped off.
Yeah.
Like the market.
And counting.
And counting. I mean, it's still plunging as we're going, on the podcast. I mean, so I wanted to ask you about the third term to begin with, but I think it's quite interesting to bring that model in of being able to remove the president and the authoritarian power that you've referenced repeatedly.
Yes. I mean, that's exactly right. There is a difference between the Westminster model and the presidential model in terms of the power of the executive. And, one way to put it, I'd say the main way I think it's most usefully described by political scientists, and especially those who study comparative politics, that's how this idea that I'm about to introduce comes out, is looking at countries abroad, not just the United States, but those who, rather than following the Westminster model, like a lot of Latin American countries and South American countries, follow the U.S. model. There's a lack of flexibility because of the four-year, basically the term, the idea that in the Constitution in the United States, for instance, it's every 4 years. We don't have elections that can be called by no confidence vote, for instance, in Parliament. So what that does is it gives, and it's what you're describing, a great example of it, that it just has a lack of flexibility. And that tilts towards the top. And then when you look also at the structure of our system, the president has control of more than 2 million people, not counting the military, absolute control of the military too, as commander in chief, with a limited sort of formal power to declare war in the hands of Congress that's largely been abandoned. So when you combine that, what your example just gets to it, that when you have a disaster or an emergency in a parliamentary model, call an election, no confidence vote. And in the U.S., we don't have anything like that. And so it really, it's not a mistake. I talk about that, listen, the presidents and the people, that when you look at these models, just the rate of failure into autocracy, a kind of self-coup is the term I've been using, where the executive basically destroys the other branches and just everything collapses into the executive, into a autocracy or dictatorship. That failure, let's say, generally of democracy. You have other kinds of coups too, of course, violent coups, but the failure of the presidential model is just way higher than it is in Westminster. In fact, one study I've seen, certainly, it's multiples of failure in the presidential model. And then when you try to figure out which presidential systems have really lasted from the beginning, the United States is one, although we're testing it right now, and Costa Rica is another, and almost all of the other presidential models fail at some point. So it really is this sort of idea of the inflexibility, the rigidity is another way to put it, of the presidential model is a real danger. That's why, I was warning from 2016 of how dangerous it is to have somebody who just disregards all the norms and, either doesn't care about them or if he knows about them. He said, for instance, I have an Article 2. It says I can do anything I want, meaning Article 2 of the Constitution, which our podcast gets the name in the book, gets the name from. Article 2 of the Constitution's supposed to symbolize the idea of the rule of law. The president has to, in the first few seconds in office, take an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. And that's laid out word for word in the Constitution to symbolize the idea that the law is above the person occupying the office. So most presidents understand that at some basic level, but when you with a few exceptions that I talk about in the book, but Trump really just didn't believe that for one second. He had he admires Putin. He admires the dictator of North Korea. He has a desire to destroy the system. And that's why this is such a truly dangerous moment in American politics.
He said the same with China, but it was a hidden recording. Someone recorded him when no one was meant to be recording. And he was talking about Xi Jinping being an excellent example of getting rid of statutory limits on how long you can be president, which is just, wild. And it seems to be this strongman thing that he's great. Do you know who the two countries were that he didn't actually put tariffs on?
Nope.
Russia, I'm going to guess.
Russia's one.
No.
North Korea?
The great trading partner. Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, Russia's I thought, wow, North Korea is even jumping the shark for him. No, the admiring. I mean, that's why. I mean, one of the things we're trying to do on the Oath in the Office podcast is to try to weave these things together. So, you know, we do talk about individual cases, and we did talk, for instance, in the episode that just came out about the question of whether or not he can run again. I'm happy to talk about it. But the danger in so much coverage, which we're not doing at all now, we're doing the opposite, is that you don't talk about the structural danger and the way that it all fits together. And when you add up, you know, his deportations and the threat to run for the third term, or the more outrageous stuff, like the threat to torture the families of suspected terrorists, what it all adds up to is a desire for an extreme autocracy. I mean, total control. You know, at the founding, John Adams admires monarchy, and he does shut down free speech because he's an admirer of the British, the idea that the British king really can't be criticized, and the idea of sedition as a law seems to him perfectly fine. That's not democratic. It's dangerous. But Trump goes way beyond, you know, an admiring of constitutional monarchy to admiring really autocracy.
Did you see what happened when Charles became the new monarch over here with the protesters getting arrested and how that took place?
I followed it a little bit, but tell me more.
It was straight. It was something straight out of North Korea, like or an authoritarian state. So we had the head of the Movement Republic on, and essentially they got arrested prior to anything taking place.
Wow.
And then there were a group of women out the night before handing out rape alarms, and the police turned up and arrested because they claimed that those rape alarms were going to be used at the coronation and thrown at the horses to scare them. So no crime was committed and they were all arrested. It's just, and so it was interesting when you mentioned the sedition order for the king. I don't think that was enacted though when they were arrested. So it was, I mean, just we're arresting you as a preemptive, they were using terrorism legislation.
Wow, they didn't even use. Very interesting. I mean, you know, I'm probably not surprising to you. I'm not a fan of monarchy. I think the British monarch is pretty well constrained. The constitutional system is well established. But in the United States, what you had was a sort of dangerous admiration of an older form of monarchy from Adams. I mean, he really thought that this is John Adams, the second president. First president really takes that oath seriously. In fact, George Washington gives a speech, the second inaugural, shortest ever given, where he says, look, I just took the oath of office. If I violate it, I want the people to criticize me, upbraid me. And if I really violate it, subject me to constitutional punishment. And you have this, that speech was written by James Madison. It really had this democratic idea that the president was part of a system constrained by the rule of law and in which the people were sovereign. And John Adams is a just totally different kind of president, the second president. We would have had a different country had he prevailed, ultimately. But he's a, you know, political theorist and studies British monarchy in particular. And even though he uses the term Republican, he has a weird definition of it, which includes monarchy. So his view is that if you criticize the president, and he was subjected to, you know, normal criticism about his, you know, hostility to France, about policies domestically, and, you know, sometimes it was colorful, but normal criticism of the head of state. And what he does is he supports and signs a sedition act and then uses it to prosecute 126 dissenters who are criticizing him. And the law, just so you see how it worked and how it almost really from the beginning destroyed American democracy, makes it a crime to criticize the president of the United States, but it's perfectly legal to criticize the vice president, Thomas Jefferson, who's a member of the opposition party. So it's really designed for a shutdown. And, you know, American historians love Adams. There's like a mini series about him. It's the most bizarre thing. He is a wannabe monarch. So you know, the courts also make things worse. Samuel Chase, Supreme Court justice, lobbies for the law and actually goes and sits on the trial of Thomas Cooper, one of the people who are prosecuted, to make sure he can't even raise the issue of free speech, that his newly passed right to free speech. He says, you can't bring that up in court. So the story of the book is, you know, this is the first instance of it. These editors really are the heroes of the book. They say, no, a right to free speech means a right to criticize the president. And they turn the election of 1800 into a referendum on democracy, really, and and result in Adams being thrown out. But not before Adams tries a plot, actually, to steal the election. He His party, anyway, has a plan, which is they're going to deny the certification of electoral votes. And the way the Constitution works in this kind of cumbersome process is if you don't get the required number of electoral votes, it goes to the House of Representatives. And his party, the Federalists at the time, they were called, realized they'd win in the House of Representatives. But one of these editors uncovers the plot. One of the opposition editors publishes it. In fact, it's discussed on the floor of the Senate. He publishes the proceedings. And of course, he's prosecuted under the Sedition Act for doing it. But it helps to limit, anyway, Adams' power. So we have this real kind of not just love of monarchy early on, but love of a kind of twisted, very authoritarian, extreme, non-constitutional monarchy, I think is how I call it.
It feels very much like history is repeating. You've got, I mean, he's literally, nothing says like a modern society than digging up an 18th century law and reusing it.
Yeah. In two ways. Wild. One is that plot, I mean, I should have laid this out. I think this might be more familiar to American listeners, but what Trump did in January 6th was very close to that plot. He and a man named John Eastman is being prosecuted for his role in January 6th. And Trump, of course, was being prosecuted as well. They were urging the vice president to refuse to certify the electoral votes, claiming that they were fraudulent, to throw things to the House of Representatives where they had the votes. It's almost the same plan. So it repeats there. And then where it's, you know, it's one of these instances, the book is, it will sound like, I'm boasting about the book, but it is just unfortunately so relevant because the 1798 period also results. Sedition Act expires and Jefferson makes sure of it. But one of the laws remains on the books now, and it's called the Alien Enemies Act. And that's what Trump is using, one of the laws from that period, to shut down opponents. And that's what Trump is using in the Venezuela case to get rid of, what he regards as enemies with no due process. We don't even know who these people are that he's deporting to a gulag in El Salvador.
We found out, we were talking about it last week. And we found out that one of the guys that got arrested had a tattoo of a football team in Spain called Real Madrid. And they thought that was a gang symbol. So, but then they've also, I think this week they've also said, if you're deported out there, there's no process to get you back.
Yeah. You're in an El Salvador gulag. And, you know, in fact, the president of El Salvador at one point was making fun of the judge that was saying, we need to see the evidence. But just to you know, the phrase due process is very lawyerly. And so sometimes people are like, well, what is that really about? Is technicality? It means that you have to show to the judge who you have and why and what your reasons are, the most basic evidentiary requirements. And they haven't had to go through that. And so, yes, in this case of the football team, the judge would have said, what are you doing? This isn't what you're saying it is. And because they're just evading that process using this law from the period of time that we're talking about, the Adams presidency, they've just evaded all of it. And, I've been using the term self-coup to describe what's going on, not just as a hypothetical possibility. If you look at what they're doing, they are certainly usurping the power of Congress and the spending power, for instance, of Congress by just cutting off funds and grants through executive orders. And then they're trying to destroy the judiciary in this Venezuela case, but also in other cases where they're denying that there are even any rights under our Constitution of free speech for non-citizens.
What do you think, and I'm going to throw this over to Madge as well, do you think, and I'm curious obviously to know from a constitutional perspective if this is possible, but a third term, like, what do you think of Trump taking on a third term, especially after the tariffs this week?
I think it's possible he would do it. I think the problem is, it require a massive change, I think, for him to get that through. And then is his health, is he going to physically going to be able to do it as well? That's another question. How much political capital is he going to spend on trying to get the changes to get a third term? Would he want to be there that long, potentially, because he's got court cases still on his head? I think it's very, very possible he would try it if he thought he might live that long and he might end up in jail for the numerous court cases he has, as mentioned a minute ago. But I think... I think he would do it. You know, Obama could come back. That'd be quite fun.
He'd wipe the floor with him, wouldn't he?
Oh, I don't know, man. Trump's a cockroach. He keeps surviving through these Democratic... his own record is impressive in a sense. I think it's likely. If he thinks he can physically do it, and he's got the political capital to do it, given how weak the Democrats are, who knows enough.
There was an estimation... this afternoon suggesting that American households are going to be added because of these tariffs, an extra $3,000-$4,000 a year to living costs. And I'm going, I think my prediction is going to be right. I think it is 2 years and he's lost the House and the Senate, and that's the end of that. That'll be a massive, massive blow to him. Corey, what is the actual possibility of him wrangling some sort of crazy interpretation of the Constitution and being able to do a third term?
I think you guys are framing it, you know, exactly right, that his ambition, he doesn't care about what the law is. I'm going to say in a second what the law is, but his whole disposition is that he, you know, is hostile to the idea of American democracy, and he's trying to destroy it. So, I mean, that's the first thing to see about this, that some people are saying it's a distraction, we shouldn't talk about it. Well, we have to talk about it in that context, that it fits together with all the other things that we've been talking about, that it is just a disregard for the rule of law. It's comparable, you know, in the United States, the 14th Amendment says if you're born in the United States, you're a citizen, full stop. So he has an executive order saying, you know, and the Constitution in our system is above any executive order or any statute. So why would you have an executive order that says that's no longer true? It's because you're trying to crash the system deliberately. And so why would you say you're going to run for a third term? We have a 22nd Amendment that says you can't be elected more than twice to the presidency. And obviously he's been elected twice. And it's because he doesn't care what the law, he not only doesn't care, he's hostile in trying to show that he's above the law. That's the whole point. Can he do it? Look, any sensible constitutional lawyer would say no way. And any sensible judge would say no way. Now, where are we going to be in 4 years with the judiciary? Has he reshaped it? Has he succeeded in impeachments? I mean, if we have pushed back in the House, for instance, by the Democrats retaking it and the judiciary holds firm, no way. No, in this day and age, it's not a hard question. But that's what he's counting on, I think, is to destroy the system, as frighteningly as that is. And in real autocracies, the courts aren't an independent check. They're controlled politically. Yep. There are maneuvers that he could try too that, you know, a lot of constitutional lawyers are getting into, some of which might work. Like he could run as vice president for Vance in a sort of Putin-esque temporary stepping away, and then Vance could step down and he could become president. Is that allowable? Well, the 22nd Amendment says you can't be vice president unless you're qualified to be president. So that's a real constitutional, that's the kind of thing constitutional lawyers argue about, that is the qualification to be president just the age requirement that you be a natural born citizen, or is it that, you know, this running for a third term, is that a kind of limit on the qualification? So that's the one scenario that's a real discussion. But, you know, the real story is, and this is completely consistent with what both of you are saying, that he doesn't care what the law is, he's trying to destroy it.
I think one of those things is he's constantly trying to pick fights with judges, and I think that helps him in his own personal court cases. Like whenever the judges kind of strike him down, you know, he will go at them directly. And I think that is one of the things he's trying to do, downplay the judiciary. So when they go after him, he claims it's a witch hunt. So I think that's part of his broader plan, because when he did the Muslim ban as well, where he tried to do it, the court struck him down on that. And, you know, everyone knew it was going to happen. He did it on purpose. It was like in the UK when they tried to deport people and the one of the courts, the European ECHR, stepped in. And they literally had people boarded on a plane. And they knew they weren't going to let the plane take off. It was all theatre. And I think that's what Trump would do in these kind of cases. Because they sent the plane, I think, to El Salvador. And the judge ordered the plane to come back.
Right.
And potentially they knew that was going to happen. And so it's all the theater of it, of the judges are stopping us. We had like a situation where a newspaper ran a headline, enemies of the people, that kind of thing. So I think that's the kind of angle he goes for. And it's a good distraction for him as well.
Yeah. And he, you know, when you add it up, it's not just that he's making fun of the judges or criticizing it. He really is trying to figure out how to destroy the judiciary. So talking about impeaching judges he doesn't agree with, this exactly as you say, claim that due process doesn't even apply, so there is no judicial oversight. CNN had me respond to Stephen Miller, you know, his close aide, who was saying that courts can't control what a president does. Now, you know, in constitutional law, like this is the first lesson, is Marbury versus Madison, which is all about the idea of judicial review, that courts have the power to tell a president what to do or what not to do. Now, for a variety of reasons in that specific case, what they wound up saying actually was, we as the Supreme Court aren't the first place to go. You have to go to lower courts. And that's exactly what Trump, even that lesson he's missing. On the Muslim ban, travel ban case, I mean, that's the one case I've been heavily involved in as an advocate, that I had an amicus brief that cited by the dissent in the Supreme Court case. But before that, as you were saying, there were many, many victories against different versions of the Muslim ban. But it's a worrying case for me because, you know, I really was a kind of pure believer that when I wrote that first book, that the courts would uphold the Constitution. And if not, there were other constitutional mechanisms short of dictatorship to keep the system in place. But that case threw me because it was so clear that it was based in hatred and what the court calls animus, anti-Muslim animus. He said it over and over again.
Yep.
But yet what they did was they kept changing it to tweak it a little. So they, interestingly, in the final third travel ban, the proclamation, they added North Korea and Venezuela to say, oh, it's not about being Muslim at all. Now, how many people came from North Korea the previous year? It was something like 4. It was not anything to do with this. And the Supreme Court upheld that final version. So it was a crushing moment because it was the same travel ban. It was so obviously animus. And we actually, in the brief, you it's a scholar's brief. I did it with two colleagues at law schools, one at Cornell and one at UVA. And then you have technically a lawyer, even though it's the scholars making the argument. And the lawyer was a Kennedy clerk. And we thought strategically, this is like Kennedy's favorite clerk. And so Justice Kennedy at the time, who was on the more progressive side, he'll say what's obvious, which is this is an anti-Muslim piece of hatred that is illegal under our guarantee of religious freedom, the First Amendment, and equal protection, the 14th. And Kennedy did the weirdest thing. He said he sided with the conservatives, and then he resigned almost immediately after. It was almost a symbolic defeat. It was a moment of resignation for the courts. The other case I'll bring up, which is just so worrying, and you can tell I'm not a fan of our Supreme Court, to say the least, this version of it. And throughout history, as I say in the book, you know, this fits with the pattern of courts really making things worse and certainly not standing up for the right thing, especially the Supreme Court. But is the immunity case. I mean, so what the Supreme Court said in Trump versus the United States, this was about January 6th, he was being prosecuted by Special Prosecutor Smith. And for the first time in American history, and this is completely made up, this is not in the Constitution, they said that a president cannot be even indicted for official acts committed while he or she was president. And Trump was claiming on January 6th that this everything that he did to steal the election was an official act. Now, the court, you know, delayed things enough that when he won, he certainly has immunity now under that decision. So he'll never be prosecuted almost for any of it. I mean, that's the unless we can do something about this Supreme Court. But that's how bad things have become. And that's why when I use the language of self-coup, it sounds extreme. But when you have the court saying a president's not above the law, a president saying there's no due process rights, that we don't have to appear in court, and then threatening to disobey court orders, not understanding the idea of judicial review, or not caring about it is a better way to put it. That's why we really are in the midst of this attempted self-coup. Self-coup meaning, you know, there's no violence. It's not like their military is coming in. It's the use of the presidency to destroy the checks on the system, Congress and the
judiciary. I guess it then comes down to that thing of, do you think it's him doing it deliberately or just him being him?
No, like, he's deliberate. I mean, I've been watching him for a long time, and it's not like he's, you know, some of the thinkers that I talk about in the book, presidents, are also thinkers. John Adams, like the premier constitutional thinker of his time, is just doesn't believe in free speech and has this authoritarian streak to him. Woodrow Wilson, who I talk about as the first white nationalist president, not the first white supremacist president, the premier constitutional thinker of his time, taught constitutional law at Princeton, was president of Princeton. Even Richard Nixon was a lawyer and had a pretty thought out, twisted idea of the presidency. Trump isn't like that, but he has an idea. And the idea is the one that we started with, that he admires dictators like the dictator of North Korea, certainly Putin. And he doesn't like, almost instinctively, doesn't like constraints. He sees the laws, you know, kind of like real estate law. You could buy the judge off or get around the ruling. And that leads him to a deeply held, I think, authoritarian idea of the presidency and of his own role in history. And that's what's so dangerous about it.
See, we had a survey over in the UK recently asking 13 to 25-year-olds what type of leadership would they like in the UK. And you take it with a pinch of salt because it's a 13-year-old, but it was also the way the question was asked. Would you be okay with giving a strong leader the ability to bypass Parliament. I think it was to that effect. It's a bit more nuanced than that. So if you're 13, you might not quite get it. It might just sound like, oh, strong leadership. We can do with that. But I think it was the majority. I think it was something crazy. Was it 60, 70% match?
I think it was quite high. It was the majority. Yeah.
It was the majority for sure. Said that they were okay with that.
Oh. And say the age again of the
13 to 25.
Wow.
So you take it with a pinch of salt. Yeah.
I would have thought the idea of the unwritten, you know, I guess this is a fantasy, but the idea of a kind of unwritten constitution, constraints, you know, in the culture that maybe aren't written down, but that are part of the culture of the UK history of constitutionalism would have been passed down. But, you know, it goes, that story I was telling about Neustadt, I really am taken with it because, you know, he was saying there was a period in American history where you learn civic education and you learned about, I mean, to me, what democracy, whether it be in the UK or in the US, is about is voting, of course, is part of it, but it's so much more. It's got to have a rule of law that you don't have leaders who can be autocrats. That's, you know, as fundamental as voting. And that there's a right to dissent, that you can criticize the leaders. That I would say the other thing is equal protection of the laws, that there's no discrimination based on race or gender or sexual orientation. Those things are so fundamental, and yet all of them are under attack in the United States, and a significant portion of our population loves the attack on these things. That's what they're going for when they vote for Trump. They like the authoritarianism, and what you're describing is an undercurrent there. I feel instinctively, intuitively, like it can't be as bad because nobody's stoking it, but it shows it's possible there too.
I guess there's an element which we're all seeing on social media where it's a manufacturing of fear.
Yeah.
That's what I've been coining it as. And it's very subtle compared to what you've had in the past, because in the past it's always been sort of top down and very clear. Whereas what we seem to have now is equivalency across, not equivalency, that's the wrong term, but we have this spreading of disinformation across social media outlets that's coming from the base. Obviously, we're all aware that actually the big difference there is the fact that the base could be like Russians or people based in Israel or people based, I think one of the countries I've been told is Nigeria. So you don't really know who you're talking to, or bots, you know, that's the other one. So you don't really know that you're hearing it from the base. I mean, this is one of the things that comes up time and time again over Brexit. We're certain that the Russians interfered. It's just that media outlets and the government don't want to talk about it. We literally had a Russian interference report, and we learned more about Russian interference in the UK through reading the US report than the UK report. Because the UK report basically said no one investigated. Wow. No one checked.
Theresa May stopped it. Prime Minister at the time, she stopped it because her party was infected with Russian money, a lot of Russian money. So she stopped any investigation into it.
And then, you know, all of this is compounded, of course, by and this will be obvious to all, you two and to listeners, but by Elon Musk, I mean, who bought Twitter. And when you listen to what his idea of democracy is, I mean, it's more crude than Trump's, which I didn't think was possible. But, you know, he thinks
he has this, and I've
been kind of listening, you know, he makes these sporadic statements. Of course, he thinks he's so brilliant in every topic. But his idea of democracy is quite simply elected dictatorship. We elected this person. He can do whatever he wants. And the idea that there are laws, the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, laws establishing these agencies that he's destroying or providing for grant. It's like that just doesn't, law does not figure in. So that first most obvious thing I was talking about, of the rule of law, to Musk, it doesn't register. And, you know, he is I would call him a civic idiot. He just has no conception of how democracy, what its principles are, or how it operates. And the fact that he's in control of, I guess, the world's biggest social media platform, maybe, I don't know how it compares to Facebook, but with Facebook, it's frightening, because the idea that he cares about free speech or equality is ridiculous. And the use and weaponization, maybe you could call it, of free speech to shut down your opponents. There's a lot of Orwell going on in the United States right now. And that's part of it, that using free speech to destroy free speech, really.
It's a bit shocking to see that it's just been, it's a slow car crash. And a group of us can say we feel that we see what's going on. And there's this group, I met a British person the other day. Oh God, I was doing some interviews in a little town called Worthing on the South Coast. And I must have interviewed about 20 people about a bunch of posters that showed Trump in a Nazi uniform and Musk in a Nazi uniform. And three people said they didn't know who Trump was, which blew my mind.
Lucky, very lucky people. Incredibly lucky.
It's a kind of ignorance is bliss.
That's, I wish I didn't know. I wish he was the guy from The Apprentice.
Yeah, he you know, of course, there are many examples of what we're talking about. You go in a variety of directions. The shutdown of free speech, really, in the Khalil case and others, while claiming to respect free speech, but they are literally saying that there's a law passed during the Red Scare in the 1950s that gives them the right to deport non-citizens for their speech. And that if you're in the United States and you say something they don't like that's adverse to the policy interests of the United States, foreign policy of the United States, they can just, it doesn't matter if you're a green card holder, permanent resident, what your status is, they can literally take you from the street and deport you. And
can you explain the Khalil case to our audience? What actually happened?
Sure. And we were fortunate last week to have the policy director of the ACLU, which is doing this case, on the podcast. So we got a level of explanation, I think, that was on the Oath in the Office that was different from even media reports. And, you know, what I got from him and also from reading a lot about it is that basically the Khalil was a leader at Columbia University in the protests about Gaza. And he was seized by ICE and is being held in Louisiana and in the process of being deported, even though his wife is a citizen and he's a green card holder. And, you know, the administration, if he had committed a crime, or there are all sorts of justifications for him, but there are actual stated justifications that under, and there are other cases like this, I should say, that's the most prominent and first one to come to prominence, but there are several others, including a Fulbright student at Tufts and other cases. But what they're saying is that there's a law passed in the 1950s. And if you look at the text of the law, it says that if you're a non-citizen who's engaged in activities that are adverse to the foreign policy interests of the United States, they can do this. They can deport you. Now, they're reading the activities to be not criminal activities or not even activities, but to be speech. That if you are saying stuff out loud and protesting, for instance, you can be deported. Now, you know, A, that's not what the law says. They're reading it in this extreme way. That's part of what the ACLU will argue. But to my mind, the most important thing that the ACLU, this is the American Civil Liberties Union, I should have said, which is the most important protector of rights through litigation in American history, extremely wealthy and effective. And a lot of our most important cases, law cases on behalf of civil liberties and democracy, come from them. So they... most importantly, are saying, and this is what's so important, is, you know, our First Amendment that we talked about in the beginning, that these newspaper editors really created in many ways, the idea that this is a right to dissent. It doesn't talk about citizens. It's a right against government interference. It's a limitation on government. So you know, they're literally just trying to destroy the Trump administration, the idea of a right to dissent. That is what they're doing. And this case is Exhibit A. And there are other ones too, but I think that's the worst.
I think there's a bit of hope in the fact that he did the tariffs this week, because I predicted in January he won't have the House and the Senate in 2 years. He'll lose the lot. And I think McKinley, 1890s, tried these tariffs, and then Smoot-Hawley tariffs in the 30s. So both of those completely wrecked it for the party that tried to implement them. I think it was Woodrow Wilson, your white right-wing nationalist. Didn't he get signed in? Isn't there a claim or a rumor he got signed in to the KKK inside the White House? Isn't there a rumor?
In the presidents and the people, there's a lot of kind of discussion of Wilson as racism. But what I really show in the book, you know, I'm recommending my own book, but this is original research too. That, you know, the book has a lot that hasn't been uncovered. But what I actually did is, I was a graduate student. I did my PhD at Princeton in politics. And I used to take a seminar a few feet from this amazing archive that was just sitting there the whole time. And it's incredible when I found it. And nobody's written about it. But what it is a box full of Wilson's students, their notebooks were collected by a librarian who realized that this was important. Anyway, nobody's looked at them. And when you look at them, what they really do is they lay out his deep philosophy, which is that the American presidency isn't about separation of powers or the Constitution or law. It's about national efficiency. And he admires Bismarck. Now, what's in the way of efficiency? He thinks one thing, and he calls it friction. And what is friction? It's integration. So the core of his constitutional philosophy is white supremacist. Now, when you look at other going to the Klan, when you look at his history book, one of the things he did is he wrote a popular history of the United States that was sold, you know, to school children and families. It's a celebration of the Ku Klux Klan in the 19th century and talking about how, you know, they went too far sometimes, but they were really heroes of the 19th century. And Birth of a Nation, which this part, you know, when you connect the dots, it's well known. He showed it in the White House, the first feature film, full-length feature
was the
film.
Birth of a Nation.
It was the Birth of a Nation. It celebrates the Ku Klux Klan. It's largely based on his textbook. And that isn't a coincidence. His close friend was the author of The Klansman, which is the novel that Birth of a Nation is based on. So Wilson is not just like a fan of the Klan. He's the inspiration for the movie that really results in the creation of the second wave of the Ku Klux Klan. In many ways, he's the creator of the Ku Klux Klan. So this isn't like a mild... And when you read the book, I haven't... It's interesting, conservatives and liberals, that's the one chapter. Adams, you know, is a great hero. So I'm trying to take down a great hero of American politics and history and people
you
like McCullough.
Giving out truth like that.
But Wilson, when people read this, I have not had one person say anything but like, am I allowed to curse on this?
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
but holy shit.
Yeah, Wilson's interesting because when I read the World War One stuff, I'm like, oh, this guy is so cool. You know, he came in, helped Europe. And then, you know, like a few months later, it's like, oh shit, he's proper racist. Like,
oh, yeah.
Like really racist. I was like, really? Wow, this is crazy. Like,
yeah. Like, and it wasn't, by the way, part of his thinking. It's core to it. I, you know, talking about Chuck, I was married in his house. My wife and I, when I was a graduate student, it was the cheapest place in town to get married. And we got married in the faculty club, which is where he used to live. And I was, you know, very happy for all the reasons that you're saying, great internationalist. And now, wow, I do not feel that way. What a real stain on American history he is.
The precursor to the UN, and then he's a massive racist.
Yes, crazy. Exactly.
Crazy.
Yeah, and he didn't, you know, he believed in democracy for white nations, but not for, you know, what he regarded as more undeveloped people. It is a deep racism in the internationalism and in certainly in domestic politics and in his view of the Constitution. But again, you know, this wasn't unnoted. One of the things I think that's important about the book is it's not that I discovered this. In real time, activists, the early really precursors of that, the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, saw this. And so William Monroe Trotter and Ida B. Wells, these early civil rights heroes, go and confront him in the White House. And they say to him, you know, you're nationalizing second-class citizenship. You're essentially creating American apartheid. And he responds by saying, you're creating friction. That's not what I'm doing. I'm just reducing friction. And you're adding to the friction, uses that language that I have in the notebooks. Jeez. So he's a frightening figure. And one that not just... What I'm trying to say, not just politically, you know, he resegregates the federal government, resegregates the military, but he also, the most dangerous thing he does is cultural. That he spreads this ideology of white supremacy. And the Klan, you know, in many ways, it has a first iteration, a second iteration around his presidency. And they imitate in their dress the movie. I mean, they're not, you know, original thinkers. It's not authentic. They just use the costumes. And that all is, you know, he's a huge part of it. He ensures that movie will be shown throughout the United States. It's, after all, it's reflecting his textbook.
Do you know the story of how Superman broke the KKK?
No.
In real life?
I want to know.
Yeah, fucking great story. So guy in one of the southern states is aware that the KKK is embedded everywhere, in the police and the fire service and government and in the township. And he's like, God, I've got to do something to get rid of them. So he signs up to one of the KKK clubs and goes in and listens to what they're all saying. And Superman is taken off as a comic book during this period. Mm. So he comes up with this amazing idea of contacting the guys that were creating the comic book at the time. I don't think it's DC. I think they take over later.
And Action Comics.
Yes, it's Action Comics. Yeah. Good knowledge. Marvel DC nerds love it.
Yeah.
So he writes to them and he says, do you want a storyline where we write about Superman infiltrating the KKK and bringing it down?
Wow.
And then he starts passing, because he's attending all these meetings, he's actually embedded, he starts passing all the passwords and everything else over to the comic strip, the Action Comics. And they start then embedding that in their stories.
Wow.
But the wild thing was, when the storyline started coming out, Superman was so popular, the kids were reading the magazine, and the KKK were turning up at the meetings and complaining because their kids were running around in their costumes and chased around as the bad guys.
Wow, amazing.
And the guys who were attending were feeling like everything that they were doing was actually really childish with all the secret codes and passwords and everything else. So they double down and they're going, right, we've got a leak. Let's change all the passwords and then we can try and figure out who's doing this. So they change it and the comic book just continues to print all the new passwords.
Amazing. I love that story because not only is it a great story, but it fits with the theme of my book, which is, you know, it's not courts. It's not even public officials that are the drivers of recovery of constitutional values, and anti-racism is certainly one of them. And it's the culture has to claim it, citizens. And, you know, I tell the story of Trotter and Wells and unknown people too, like Sadie Alexander, who is a member of the Truman Commission, who really angles for the recovery in many ways of the idea of equal protection. And the cultural story of recovery from Wilson, this sounds like it's a big part of it. So great. Thanks for telling it to me.
Be sure to tune in next week for another exciting story from the files of Police Squad.
Madge, the world has come to an end. Huge nuclear fallouts, and basically the governments have collapsed. Madge, you're going to step into the breach.
Okay.
But you've only got two choices of how you can lead. You can either become the chosen one, and you're going to have like... Oh, look at that face. You're so chuffed with that.
It's already, yes. It's done.
However,
stop the count.
You get to be dictator, you get to rule, but there's a religious element attached to it.
Right.
The problem is, at the end of your term, you will be crucified as part of the religious.
All right.
Full circle. The alternative is, you get to live a little bit of a life like Stalin. You become a dictator, but you become more and more paranoid as you go along. You lose your friends, family, wife, everything. You don't trust anyone by the end of it.
Right.
Which one do you choose?
Okay, now, is there any way out of the crucifixion? Can I jump off a bridge?
They will save you. Whatever you try and do, you've got a bodyguard of loyalists.
I'm Joseph Stalin then. I'm going for Stalin.
All right. Paranoid and loyal.
I'm going to kill all my best generals and then complain that my army sucks.
Corey, I had to put a bit of effort into this one. You get to rewrite the American Constitution in any way you want. However, Constitution can only be accessed through an app. And the only three people that have designed the app correctly... and they get money for every time it's accessed. $8.99 every time. Musk, Trump, or Kanye West.
Wow.
Nice.
Who do you choose to benefit?
Oh, wow. I love it. You did. I. Brilliant. You know, I like the idea, too, that you know, there is cost to changing the American Constitution, so it's a good metaphor. You know, Musk is so rich anyway that a little more money might not matter. So I think the first thing I'm going to do is support an amendment that I worked on with a law professor who was one of my teachers, actually, Larry Lessig, to get money out of politics. We organized an event actually at Brown. He was really a leader of this movement, and I was a much smaller part of it, but to reverse the Citizens United case, and more importantly, to clear the way for legislation that would take money out of politics. So I think what I'm going to say is I don't care that Musk and these other clowns are going to get rich. That the key is to try to figure out a way to siphon off the wealthy and the oligarchy, what makes them an oligarchy is their influence on politics. So it's going to be worth it to give them some more money in the interests of cutting off their power.
Alex, I've got one. I got one for you quickly. Okay. You have to watch a 1v1 basketball match, Kim Jong-un versus Donald Trump for an hour, or you have to play golf with Donald Trump. You can't beat him. And at the end of every time he gets one in, he's going to talk about how he's the best golfer ever. What are you going to do?
You know, I'm going to go for the basketball. The reason I'm going to go for the basketball is because there's every single chance that Trump will have a heart attack, which will that would make it worth it.
It's just free throws. It's just free throws. So you're going to watch them airball every shot.
Oh my God, you're about to be in basketball rules where you don't need to be fit to be able to play.
And then for the professor, where can people watch your podcast and buy your books from? All good platforms for your podcast?
We're on Apple, Spotify, and all platforms. It's called The Oath in the Office. We're forming a community around it. People are writing in questions, and we're talking about all these issues that I've been talking about with you. And my co-host is a comedian and, fun person, so he lightens the mood in a way that I was happy to see you guys do it, too. You can buy, too, a copy of The Presidents and the People, and the subtitle is Five Leaders Who Threaten Democracy and the Citizens Who Fought to Defend It. And it's about people like Adams, who shut down free speech, and Woodrow Wilson, who we talked about, who nationalized white supremacy, and also heroes like those newspaper editors. The true hero of the book is Frederick Douglass, formerly enslaved person, who I called the true founder of American democracy for teaching us how to read the Constitution as a protection of multiracial equality. And other heroes, I interviewed Daniel Ellsberg for the book not long before he died, the anti-war protester also leaked the Pentagon Papers. Check it out. It's on, I know there is a UK release. It's in Blackwell's and all British bookstores. It's on Amazon UK and Amazon US. Read it and join us on the podcast. And what a pleasure. I'm so glad that we did this. It was really fun and interesting.
That's really good to hear.
Makes me miss university.